This is Matt Wells at UN News. It's widely accepted that peaceful protests are a key tool in democratic societies that allow people to put issues on the public agenda. But what is legal and what's illegal when it comes to demonstrations around the world? Can you wear a mask, for example? That's a question for Christoph Haines, who led discussions on the issue for the UN Human Rights Committee with member states and NGOs. In an interview with UN News' Daniel Johnson, the veteran rights expert Professor Haines explains what the UN panel's advice is for protesters and governments, according to its just-released general comment on the right to freedom of assembly.
So, yes, indeed, the Human Rights Committee adopted an interpretation of the right of peaceful assembly. We worked on it over the last 2 years, but last week we finalized this process. So this is to explain to states and to populations around the world, what do we mean when we say everybody has a right of peaceful assembly? So almost all the states in the world are state parties to the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, but merely to say that there's a right of peaceful assembly, what does it mean? When is an assembly peaceful? When does it become violent? What can the police do? What can be expected from the participants? And what can the participants expect from society? We had a draft, which we then shared with the world, and we got comments from 24 states, including 3 permanent members of the Security Council, more than 100 NGOs and other interested parties. And we then incorporated many of those comments into the final draft, which we then finished. It was an online process, actually, because of COVID. Over the last month, we met for 4 weeks every day. And at the end of that, we were then able to issue this about a 20-page document that sets out the details of what this right actually entails and what are the obligations on states.
Right. So among the, just drilling down a little bit, one of the things you said in this general comment was that people who want to peacefully protest and peacefully demonstrate can wear hoods and masks. That obviously hasn't gone down massively well with lots of states, and I wanted to know what the kind of pressures the Human Rights Committee was under to take those comments on board, but at the same time respect the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights.
So we took it as the starting point that it's up to people to decide how they want to dress, how they want to project themselves, but then there may be exceptions. So we say this is important as a starting point to say that one can actually cover your face if you want to, because it may be part of your demonstration. So, you know, those protests where people wear, for example, a mask with the face of a politician on it because they want to, in a way, make a caricature or convey a message. It may also be because they want to protect their privacy. It may also be because they are worried about retaliation against them. So they may be not feel safe. So based on those considerations, we say generally people should be able to do so. But of course, if there's reasonable grounds to suspect that somebody has committed a crime, for example, then the authorities may require a person not to wear a face mask. You know, it's just reasonable to think if they want to arrest somebody, for example, they must be able to make sure what's the identity of the person.
Okay, talking about identities, there's been a lot of debate about the arrival on the scene in protests of unidentified law enforcement officers. What's your input in this general comment from the Human Rights Committee on the obligations of states to really play by the rules, by the covenant on their side of the fence?
Yeah, so the general obligation on the state is to respect and endure assemblies, and that has a negative and a positive component. The negative is that in many cases they must simply allow it to happen, but also the positive component is it may be necessary to facilitate some assemblies. So, for example, if it's in a street with busy traffic, it may be necessary to block this off. So that's a general obligation on the state, but it's also important then, in addition, for any law enforcement activities to be done in a transparent sort of way, so that one doesn't have the kind of society where unknown people come and they haul you off into an unmarked vehicle and that's the last that is seen of you. So if there's state authority that's being exercised, if needed arrest or force used, that is clear that it comes from the state. So the principle is transparency. So the starting point is that police officers, law enforcement officials must be identifiable. So it could be their name, for example, it could be a number, but that everybody knows that there is the potential, if things go wrong, of accountability afterwards. We do accept that in some cases it may be necessary for a state to use plainclothes police officers. So, for example, if you have a crowd of 1,000 people and there are people who infiltrate and want to make trouble, want to commit violence to discredit the entire assembly, And if they use violence, for example, that has to be dealt with by the state. So plainclothes police officers may play a role there. And although some people argue they should never play a role, we accept that, that states may have such an interest. But if they then start using coercive powers, arresting or they're using force, they first have to identify themselves before they can do so.
And would you say that there is increasing use in so-called less lethal weapons in recent years, or is it just because of the Black Lives Matter movement following the death of George Floyd in police custody that really has brought this into focus?
Well, you know, the technology is available these days to see these things wherever it happens. People have cell phones and so forth. So I think we do have more coverage of its use now. But I have no doubt that demonstrations are a very widely accepted form of expressing oneself worldwide in many societies that didn't have it before. So there are more demonstrations. In my country, there are 12,000 per year, and in many other countries as well. So there are more demonstrations, and there's also more use of these kinds of weapons. And that's why we felt it's important that the rules of the game, the rules of engagement, that that becomes more clear, that so all the parties know what to expect from each other and to know that there are boundaries within which they operate.
So what is your advice to protesters? What is it in a nutshell? Why is protesting so important? What's a part of the democratic toolbox does it represent?
Yes, I think the demonstrations often serve as a sort of safety valve for pressure in society. It's a way for people to go out and say, here I stand, and I stand here to be counted. I feel very strongly about this particular issue, and in a way, deal with me and deal with the fact that we are 1,000 people or 2,000 people who are willing to come out and to demonstrate. And in that way, it's a warning to society. But it's not necessarily a way of engaging in confrontation, because it's saying this is a problem that needs to be dealt with. And collectively as a society, we have the opportunity to do something about this. There's ample research that show that peaceful assemblies are often more effective than violent resistance in terms of achieving its own objectives. So once a threshold is crossed and violence is used, in particular, I'm not talking about minor sort of violence, but if it's violence that involves injury or death, or serious destruction of property, it's very difficult to go back once that has happened, and that polarizes society. And so in many cases, those problems are not really resolved. They rather become frozen or entrenched in the community. But through nonviolence, there's often the possibility of going back. There's not a threshold that's crossed, and now people are up in enemy lines against each other. So often things can be resolved. I'm not saying that this is always the case, but in many, many cases, problems can be resolved. And if we look at what happened in the world in the last 50 years, many of the major changes came about because of peaceful assemblies. So if one looks at the end of the de jure racial discrimination in the US through the civil rights movement, that was renegotiating the entire social contract there. The fact that how women before that got the vote was through demonstrations. In my country, South Africa, apartheid, largely because of demonstrations. Fall of communism, 89, even the fall of Slobodan Milosevic. And so major changes, the way in which we look at the environment today, the way we look at gay rights, the way we look at particular armed conflicts, many of those things have been significantly influenced by nonviolence and by peaceful assemblies. So it's one often thinks about it as you can either do nothing or then you can engage in nonviolent resistance. And then there's a third sort of step, ultimate one, if nothing else works, that's where you go. But from my perspective, it's often not really necessary to go that last step, because there's the tool to actually address these things in a forceful way, which is often very successful. And that's why I think it's so important that societies around the world not just tolerate, but also facilitate this opportunity for the underlying pressures to be put out into the open and to be addressed. And in some cases, of course, people organize an assembly and they think a million people are going to go, and then it's only 10 of them. And then they see there's not really appetite for this kind of idea in society. So it's a very important tool to test support for a particular idea, both for the broader society and for those who are engaged in it. So they have a reality check about how much support there is for what they are proposing.